This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Let's shift gears now from Iran to Africa. The United States has about 6,000 troops in Africa right now. 6,000. And there's a lot to pay attention to across the continent. Changing demographics, economic opportunity, outside influences, including China, and internal conflicts that threaten some nations' development. How does the Trump administration view these challenges today, and what policies are in place to deal with them? The administration's point man on Africa is Donald Yamamoto. He's had a long career at the State Department, including as ambassador to Ethiopia from 2006 to 2009 and ambassador to Djibouti from 2000 to 2003. In early September, he was named acting assistant secretary of state for African affairs, and he joins us here in studio. Ambassador Yamamoto, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'd also love to hear your questions or thoughts about America's role in Africa, especially if you have experience living there or working there, or if you are from the continent and have reflections on what you see in America's policies there. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Ambassador Yamamoto, a lot of what we hear about Africa has to deal with war and famine and disease outbreaks and groups like terrorist groups like Boko Haram or the slaughter of endangered wildlife. It's pretty downbeat. I wonder if we could start with something positive. I'm sure that you and your perspective in Africa have a view of the bright spots that are there. What do you think are the one or two brightest spots about Africa and U.S. policy toward Africa that you wish more Americans knew about?
Okay. Well, just a couple of things. First of all, if you take Africa as a Kodak shots, if you look at Africa today and compare it to 20 years ago, you can see the progress made across the continent over the last couple of decades. Let me give you a couple examples of where areas that were progressing. If in this administration, the objectives and goals is to increase American wealth and also the trade investment, then let's look at some of the opportunities. So the State Department provides the ACE Award, which is for companies that have done very well around the world. And a couple of companies that have done well in Africa. One of them is Procter & Gamble. When McDonald received the award, he said that he made the first million and the first $1 billion in profits faster in West Africa than he did in China. And that's because of the diaspora providing goods and services to their own families, and they start looking for those products. Another area, too, that we kind of look at is I call Africa really the final frontier for opportunities and opportunities. The issue is if you look at your cell phone, you know, like 10% of that products that go into your cell phone comes from Africa. In the next decade or so, that's going to be much more, 25%, 30%. And if you look at the countries that are looking at the rare earth minerals and resources, and they range from North Korea, Iran, Russia, as to other countries like Israel and the former colonies, as I said, UK, France, and Germany. So those are kind of opportunities. But one thing that's really great is that the programs and projects that previous presidents and, of course, this administration is advocating, one thing is the YALI program. I think that is one of a focal point. YALI is, we've now, in the last couple of years, since the end of the Obama administration, we have about 550,000 youth, young African leaders organized into community groups across the continent. And this is going to really be the kind of the base for development and relations between the United States and Africa. And if you look at Africa, if over 70% is under the age of 30 and really close to 25, then this is an opportunity we need to pay attention to.
So there's the economic, just to sum up what you described, there's the economic opportunity, these emerging markets that have,
yes.
Well, really some are emerging, some have already really emerged and
right.
are doing global business.
Yes.
And then the potential to uplift young people through initiatives
right.
like YALI, the Young African Leaders Initiative,
yes.
to try to capitalize on the fact that so much of Africa's population is basically millennial and
yes,
eager to do big things.
Yes. And that's where it goes to the basis of Secretary Tillerson, and we held a ministerial back in November. And if you look at the population growth rate, in the next, between now and 2030, 2050, the population of the world will grow by 2.2 billion. About 1.3 billion will come from Africa. And if you look at the population growth rate, it's about over 70% will be under 30, and 25% of the world's labor force will be African. And so that really is an opportunity. So right now, Africa's population is about 16% of the world. By 2050, it'll probably be around 30%.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It's funny you bring up population growth. We will be talking about the world's population growth at this time tomorrow. More on that in just a moment. But let's talk about some of the other stories across Africa that have gotten some of our attention. Let me start with one that I think we've been following, which was in South Africa. Its president, Jacob Zuma, might not be in office too much longer. We saw Zimbabwe's longtime dictator, Robert Mugabe, ushered out of office last year. He had been in office basically as long as I've been alive. There's a lot going on with some of Africa's largest democracies. What would the administration like to see happen specifically as it relates to South Africa, Zimbabwe, these democracies that the world is really paying a lot of attention to?
I think these are really good news stories. In 2018, we'll see 18 democratic elections take place in the continent. And if you look at the number of countries that are democratic or democratic leaning, it's gone from when I first started over 25 years ago to maybe several, to now we have over two dozen. That means greater stability, governments that are accountable to the people. And so if we see the elections that just took place in Liberia, the first transition of a government in over 70 years. You see opportunities in Zimbabwe, still work in progress that we're working on. And of course, South Africa, which is probably one of the largest economies on the continent. We saw elections in Nigeria, and they'll come up again. But these are points of really development and positive notes on the continent.
Talk a little bit more about Liberia. I was going to get to that one next. The race for the successor to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, which has since been resolved. There's been an election. Talk about what the administration's focus is with regards to these democratic transitions. I think President Trump has made it really clear he doesn't want to be in the nation-building business. So it's a lot more hands-off. But if these democracies are not stable, then that's bad for the U.S. So where does U.S. policy fall on these democracies and ushering them along?
So for the United States, our focal point is to really develop and ensure that these countries, A, are accountable to the people. Number two is develop economic opportunities for a young population. And so, you know, if we're talking about in the United States that we're supposed to create 200,000 jobs a month. But in Africa, if you talk about a population growth and a large youth population, then you're going to have to create lots of jobs per month. And that's one of the things that we're trying to work with Africa to see where the opportunities are to address the growing youth.
Are you seeing enough of a connection? Do American businesses, do you get the sense that American businesses, especially small businesses, really understand A, what the opportunities are, and B, how to tap into them? I'm sure there's lots of parts of the country that would love to be doing more business in Africa if they just knew how.
That's right. And that's a really good question. So from Clinton to Bush to Obama and now to the Trump administration, we've had AGOA. AGOA really has been kind of an impetus and stimulus for economic development. Right now, the United States, we export probably about $25 billion worth of trade and investment.
I'm sorry, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act.
Right. Okay. So right now, our investment in Africa has really grown from several billion to right now $57.6 billion in the last year. Imports is about $11 billion. Exports is about $26 billion. And so there's opportunity and expansion. One of the areas that we're looking on is electrification. In other words, you can't have economic growth without access to electricity and to power. And so Power Africa, one of the big programs that we're looking at, is going to help revolutionize Africa and also to move it into from agriculture to industrialization into a service industry sector. And I think a lot of countries like Procter & Gamble, Boeing Aircraft just sold several billion dollars of aircraft to Ethiopia, also to Rwanda, Angola, and to other countries on the continent. That means they're saving on the U.S. side, 35,000 U.S. jobs. And on the other side, creating jobs in Africa.
We're speaking to Acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Donald Yamamoto, former ambassador to Ethiopia and Djibouti about America's policies toward Africa. We'd love to hear from you, too. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Chris was a Peace Corps volunteer in Cameroon back in the 80s. He says he's active in the African community in Houston, Texas. Chris writes, "My question concerns countries like Cameroon, which has a firmly pro-France government, but also is incompetent, corrupt, and has an 85-year-old leader contemplating another term in office and has a poor human rights record. Will the Trump administration push for good governance or settle for reliable allies, particularly in Francophone West Africa?"
So as I said, we have 18 Democratic elections coming up in 2018. We note that, and Secretary Tillerson said this very clearly in the budget issues, is that democracy is really an important basis for getting countries to develop, but also to be held accountable and also stable. And so one of the, I'll give you an example, is, you know, during my time for the last two decades, I used to go visit Africa, countries where you had, you know, longtime dictators, and how to move them forward. And one of the things that we were in Senegal talking to Wade as the transition from there into Macky Sall, and Wade said, you know, what we want to do is, if you're trying to threaten us and try to move us, look at the diaspora in the United States and other countries, because there they providing a lot of money and investments in the countries. And he's absolutely correct. And so the diaspora in the United States and other countries have a stake in what's happening in Africa. And so we have people, I've been to, let's say, Minneapolis to talk to the Somali community, the Ethiopian community, to get their views about how we can do a better job in addressing the needs of the people in those countries, but more important, how to hold governments accountable to the people. And
do you get the sense, though, that African governments are eager for America's help so that they can become better partners to America, or so that they can become more self-actualized on their own? I mean, I'm ashamed to say how little I knew about kind of Africa's history of development outside colonialism. I don't know if anybody has watched season 2 of The Crown, but episode 7 was a real revelation to me about the history of Ghana. I wonder how much you get the sense that African nations are looking to do their own thing and work kind of with the U.S.
Yes.
And not feel like they end up working for the U.S.
That's right. That's correct. And just going back to what you were saying, when we transitioned from Wade into Macky Sall, much more democratic, much more accountable to the people.
You're talking about the transition from president to president in Senegal.
Right. And that's, and then same thing in Ghana, which has a tradition of having democratic elections. Kenya, Ethiopia, we're moving Ethiopia in the right direction as well on democracy issues. So those are issues and areas that we're really working very closely with and trying to move the system forward. Because if you have a high youth population growth, they demand things that will address their needs and benefits for the future. And then their success is going to be our success.
You mentioned Ethiopia. Gesha wrote on our Facebook page, "The Secretary Tillerson, recently visited Ethiopia, where the human rights condition has reached a very critical level, especially in suppressing its largest nation, the Oromo people. Please discuss what the U.S. policy is regarding the deteriorating human rights condition in that country."
So I just came back from Ethiopia, and we are looking at an uptick in ethnic tensions between the Oromo and the Somali region, but just not in Ethiopia. It's in southern Sudan, it's in the Congo, it's in other places. And we're trying to figure out how to bring more opportunities and bring accountability. And in those areas, we've looked at not only long-time problems with labor and also, government policies, and also how to address the needs of each of the communities to bring them closer together. And those are the areas that we're trying to work very closely. And we'll be very closely in contact with the Ethiopian government, but not in Ethiopia, across the continent, from southern Sudan to Congo to other areas, to make the life for the people tomorrow much better.
I'm sorry, Gesha, I think you were referring to Ambassador Yamamoto visiting Ethiopia rather than Secretary Tillerson. Sorry about that. But I do wonder, though, about Gesha's question. I mean, this effort to further democracy is in some ways arm in arm with human rights. And Secretary Tillerson has spoken in the past about being able to separate America's calculus on human rights from its calculus on diplomatic policy. But you can't have a democracy, at least in an American Western sense, if human rights aren't part of the equation. So how do you do that?
So the purpose of our ministerial that Secretary Tillerson hosted for 37 countries last November, the basis is looking at Africa in the year 2100, when it's 40% of the population, you have over 75% of the population under 30 and probably under 25, and the prospect of high unemployment if we don't address their needs, is that you can't have economic development unless it's carefully integrated into political reform, economic reform, protection of human rights, and democratic values. Why is that? Because if you're not free to create and to think and to act, then you're not going to be as creative and innovative as you can be. So that's one of the things that the secretary wanted to know. The other issue, too, is if you heard the deputy secretary talking about Nigeria before the House, he said that, you know, radicalization of African terrorists, one of the things that we noticed, and according to the UN report, is that 71% of all those African terrorists were first radicalized because of the abuse they received from the security sector. And so, therefore, security sector reform is one major step, as well as protection of human rights, in order to move the democratic, but mostly also the economic programs forward. Because you can't have economic development without these integrated portions as well.
We have to pause in just a moment, but I wonder if we could get to one more question before we have to pause. John Paul asks, you're talking about creating more potential government leaders, about selling things, and then resource extraction. None of those things will create the billions of jobs the population and the continent needs. What are we doing to build an African economy and not simply extract wealth?
And we're not extracting wealth, we're developing wealth. As you know, the United States' main purpose and goals is to see how we can have the people of these areas benefit from the results. So I'll give you an example. I've been to the Congo for, you know, off and on for the last couple of decades, and they have rich resources like titanium and tellurium, tungsten, tin. And those products are used not only for high-grade drill bits, but also for military purposes, for missiles, etc. That's why you have North Korea and Iran and Russia there. The other issue, too, is that we're looking at the opportunities for all countries and all the people, how they can benefit. One last thing is that what we're trying to do for Africa is that they can benefit if they can break down non-tariff trade barriers and also all these other corruption issues. If they can, we can create $100 billion in wealth just from doing those issues.
I see what you're getting at. I am still interested in the other piece of John Paul's question. If you mine those resources out of Africa, they're gone. Who is profiting from the mining? And what other countries like China, are they profiting from the resources that are mined? We'll get to that in a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Ambassador Donald Yamamoto, Acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, the Trump administration's top man on Africa. There's still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts about America's relationship with African nations. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Ambassador, to continue with John Paul's question, I hear you in terms of Africa's abundance in some of the rare earth minerals that go into basically every computerized device that we have. But once you extract those minerals, they're gone. And the wealth comes from being the guy who works in the mine to go get them. What about the people who own the mining company, or who are doing the import-export, or who are financing the transactions? Are we developing that part of African trade, or are we just going there to extract the wealth?
And, you know, we've had too many instances where we have oil-producing countries which actually are poorer than countries that are not oil-producing because of the corruption and because of the lack of accountability.
Exactly.
And so what we've tried to do in these countries is to build strong institutions, accountability to the people, so that they benefit. So in other words, going into the Congo, for instance, and all these really rare earth minerals and other products that are being mined by North Korea, Iran, Russia, China, other countries, but also Western countries as well, is how do the people benefit? And so building institutions, building accountability, and looking at rational ways of developing these resources will help develop and also to benefit the people in those areas. And then that goes back to one of our basic areas is to how do we do interstate trade and other trades? So for instance, a country in, let's say, Ethiopia, their main partner would be Italy. It shouldn't be Italy, it should be the other countries. In other words, by breaking down non-tariff trade barriers, fighting corruption, opening up the trade between countries within Africa, we can produce over $100 billion in added income. Now, granted, Europe and the United States will remain and should be a main trading partner, but they should also trade with each other. So going back to the resources that you were raising, so if we can work with not only outside developers, but also countries and governments and companies to really help benefit. I'll give you a couple examples. So the United States, we have we send our people into countries. We look at the sectors. We see how we can develop it and produce. So for instance, when Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods won the Masters, they're wearing high-tech leather. Where did that come from? It came from Africa. And so we, the United States, went in and started developing the leather markets so that the people in Ethiopia, Uganda, South Africa, and Kenya can benefit from that and also get marketing and branding from that issue.
When you say the benefit in terms of trading and that high-tech leather among those countries individually.
That's right.
So it sounds like what you're describing is kind of multifaceted, but part of it, if I'm hearing you correctly, is making sure that African nations have the kind of stable democratic institutions that allows them to do kind of a smaller version of what the U.S. can do.
That's right.
Where we can basically trade with whoever, with our neighbors or with someone across the world.
Yes.
That sounds like it butts right up against nation building and human rights advocacy and being involved in it, writing constitutions. It sounds like it butts right up against all that kind of stuff that President Trump has said that he wants the U.S. to mostly stay out of. That's kind of a tough tightrope to walk.
See, is that we work with Africa as partners. And in that partnership is what we can help them achieve on their own accord, et cetera. It's not something we are dictating. We're not. It's something that they want and that they desire and that we're going to help them. I'll give you one other example. It's a great American program that has really been successful and is expanding under this administration, and Secretary Tillerson has advocated, and that's the ACOTA process. In other words, the Africa Contingency Operations Training Program. So in the past decade, the United States State Department has trained over 300,000 troops, African troops from 26 countries to participate in peacekeeping operations. Why is that important? Well, if you look at UN operations today, 63% are dealing with peacekeeping operations in Africa. 87% of UN troops, that's about over 60,000, are now in Africa. But if you look at all the troops in those peacekeeping operations, UN and African Union, 70% are African, and most of them have been trained by the United States. It started under Susan Rice when she was there, and Johnny Carson, and Linda Thomas Greenfield, my predecessor. And this is a big program because they are providing security on their terms at their own issues, and we're providing support and assistance.
Let me ask you a little bit more about America's military role in Africa, since you brought that up. One of the stories that we had been following a few months ago had to do with this ambush last fall when 4 U.S. troops and 5 Nigerian soldiers were killed in an ambush in Niger, which sits kind of between, it's north of Nigeria and south of Libya. After the ambush, John Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff and a retired Marine Corps general, was asked what American troops were doing there. Here is some of what the Chief of Staff said.
So why were they there? They're there working with partners, local Africa, all across Africa in this case, Niger, working with partners, teaching them how to be better soldiers, teaching them how to respect human rights, teaching them how to fight ISIS so that we don't have to send our soldiers and Marines there in their thousands. That's what they were doing there.
That was White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. So, Ambassador Yamamoto, I take the Chief of Staff's point. We're training African soldiers to do this work so that we don't have to do this work. They can kind of do it themselves in their own country and we can advise. But after this ambush, I wonder how that advisory work has changed in the intervening months? Is it still the same? Have we learned anything after that ambush?
Our troops, and I've been to the training programs for the Ugandans, Ethiopians, and Kenyans and Djiboutians as they enter into Somalia, where they have taken tremendous amount of hits and sacrifices. But the areas that our troops are there to provide not only assistance but guidance and to really up their game as they face really a very hard groups from Shabab to Boko Haram to ISIS West Africa, and now there was a formation by the Africans themselves called the G5 countries, which includes Mauritania, Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, and also helping support the Lake Chad area, which includes Cameroon, Nigeria, is that these countries want to have an upgrade in their military capabilities, and that's what the United States is doing. And going back to General Kelly, who he and I have taught together the elite programs at Pinnacle for the U.S. military, that we look at the U.S. military providing a support, but also dimensionally different and upgrading of their capabilities so they can address all these challenges that are coming in from outside the continent, but also from within the continent.
When we say upgrading their capabilities, are we talking about, I don't mean to be super crass about this, but are we just talking about selling them more guns, or are we teaching them how to use the guns they have more effectively? Is it about teaching tactical training? Are we arming them? I mean, what are we doing?
No, I mean, we're providing in many aspects, non-lethal aspects. We do provide some weapons, but basically it's bread and butter. It's going to be training. It's how to do tactics. How do you do, research and surveillance? How do you do protection? So one of the things that, I'll give you one example. So Mozambique has a flood. You know, every couple of years there's a flood. When they see the U.S. military, the U.S. military is there providing assistance. Yet you don't see a lot of African countries. And so what happens is what we've done now through our training program is our African troops are providing the basic civil affairs and civil assistance that our troops have done in other areas. And so their capability is not only security-wise fighting ISIS and Shabab, but also winning the hearts and minds of providing basic care and assistance to the people of the country that they're protecting. That is one of the areas, and this is what they want, and this is what we're providing.
Let's get to a few more of your questions and comments in the time we have left. Regarding terrorism, Alex asked, I was wondering if the Trump administration's policy of wanting to combat extremist groups but without nation building would really work. If you just kill the quote-unquote bad guys, but don't address the root causes like famine, ethnic strife, bad economies, and build up nations, won't these extremist groups just spring up again under a different name?
Sure, and that's a very good point. When we were working with General McChrystal and Admiral McRaven on issues, and you know, I served in Afghanistan. My two children are in the U.S. Army, and just talking to them and talking to our top military leaders, what we're trying to achieve is that you can't constantly kill terrorists. That's not the answer. The answer in issue is how is it that you can build communities, societies. How is it that you can address those needs of those people to address the security that they're going to address? We can't do it for them. We cannot want it more than they do. And in these instances that we have, let's say, the training of African Union troops in Somalia, is because they wanted to do it. We provide the means, we provide the technology, the know-how, and the support and assistance. That's our job.
Sina writes on Twitter, China seems to be investing and developing without the demand for democratization and human rights reform. Also, Augustine writes, I'm dismayed by the U.S. ceding Africa to China. And Harry in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania writes, hasn't China already signed up all the African nations with infrastructure for natural resource deals? Or are we just supposed to help out in the policing aspects of the continental agenda? And doesn't the U.S. do too much of that around the world as it is? What about our competition with China for economic and cultural toeholds in Africa?
Okay. So our relations with China is very complex. And I think was very telling, we had a meeting with the chairman of their U.S. of their Chinese military. And, you know, if you talk to them about the South China Sea, it's a very emotional issue. You talk about Africa, He's very relaxed, and he says there's more opportunities to discuss, and that's what we've been doing. So next month, we'll be going into discussions, which we hope will be annual, we've done in the past, with China about what is our respective interest? Where is it that we can coordinate, cooperate? And those areas where we differ, how can we resolve those problems? I'll give you examples. So we asked the Chinese to provide an engineer battalion into Sudan during the conflict there. They did. When we talked to them about infrastructure development, because we don't do a lot of infrastructure, the Chinese do, into certain areas, they did. But again, we also have cautionary tales about the re-indebtedness of Africa. As you know, we've gone through the HIPC. This is high, indebted countries, and how to relieve them from debt burdens. We were very successful, but now we're seeing countries being re-indebted 50% to 200% of GDP. That's unacceptable.
Heavily indebted poor countries.
That's right. And so we asked China, is that you can't give low concessionary loans, these attractive, alluring loans to countries to re-indebt them or to play on corrupt dictators, etc. We need to work together to ensure that there's economic vitality, because you, China, and other countries, you want to have trade and investment. So let's do that.
Maybe on the flip side of the business accountability piece, we got a message from Jordan, who wrote, I ran a small farming startup in Indiana focused on building seed stocks and teaching modern techniques in Angola. We failed terribly after our partners reneged on the contract and failed to provide support required. Could the ambassador talk about how the State Department is working to protect the small businesses that he's encouraging to enter this market?
Sure. And that's part goes back to Secretary Tillerson's hosted ministerial, is to, if we're going to do an investment at $57 billion this year and increasing, and our trade is going to be at this time $26 billion, it's going to increase, then we need to have accountability, protection, legal processes, strong institutions that will protect not only American investors, because if you don't have those protections, you're not going to attract the right American businesses possible. So that's one of the areas that we're looking at very closely.
I definitely do want to ask you about the State Department directly in the little time that we have left. You served as senior advisor to the Director General of the Foreign Service on personnel reform a few years ago. We've heard a number of reports about morale at the State Department. The president's initial budget called for a 37% budget cut. The cynic in me suggests that what you're talking about in terms of economic opportunity through our diplomatic corps probably stands a better chance of protection from budget cuts because it generates economic opportunity. Is that the reality? Is our foreign policy going to be that much more transactional where the human rights piece, for example, gets advanced in our diplomatic agenda insofar as it's connected to the economic piece? I mean, before we're out of time, what are you seeing from the inside?
So the economic portion is only a part of a broader, comprehensive, interrelated program that deals with good governance, institution buildings, and providing the security that they want. Now, going back to the Director General issue, so I did a lot of data collection. So quick factoid. So
Very briefly, we're almost out of time.
So we have about 20 to 30,000 apply for the Foreign Service each year, and we'll get, you know, anywhere. In the past, we had 500. That's about the normal. Now we're about 200 to 280. So it's a very competitive process. So the issue is that we have more people at the millennial and very young generation than the old generation. And so therefore, we're very different from other agencies. So we have, I think, a ability to create creatively and innovatively, look at things differently, and I think that's going to translate into better policy in the future.
And those millennials coming into the State Department, are they going to come into a department that has the resources it needs, that has the people it needs, that has the morale it needs to do great work around the world?
We are going to provide the leadership, and I think that's the critical key. I train our ambassadors and our deputies and senior officers. We train about leadership. That is protecting your people, looking after their needs, developing them, and creating opportunities for them to grow and develop, just as we are doing it in Africa. Leadership. That is what we do best.
Donald Yamamoto is Acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador, thanks very much for talking to us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.